This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with Katie Pribble, the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association Senior Vice President for Aviation Strategy and Programs. Katie describes the AOPA's You Can Fly program and the Air Safety Institute. In the news, we look at increasing student enrollment in flight training programs, adhesive bonded splice joints as an aircraft assembly method, the White House nominee for the open NTSB member, and Ryanair's strategy for pilot retention. All that and a lot more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 471 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me first is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a CFI, an author, and as we like to say, a glass cockpit expert. Max T, how are you?
Max, I'm excellent. Having fun here in sunny California. I was down at the beach over the weekend. It was my birthday, and had a lot of fun just walking around. And, oh, I got to tell you, we spotted some whales when we did an overflight over the Monterey Bay a couple of days ago.
Cool. So,
yep, lots of whales down there feeding. And so it's a fun time of year out here.
39 years old, right?
Yeah. How did you know?
Same as last year, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Also with us is David Vanderhoof, our favorite Airplane Geeks historian. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Looking forward to a good show, and I, for once, am going to be the geek traveling this week. I leave tomorrow night for Toronto for the big drone show and visit family, so I will be out of the country. I'm looking forward to cramming myself into a E-jet with horrendous seat pitch. Thank you, American Airlines.
All right, that'll be a great trip. Looking forward to hearing your observations from the big drone show. Also with us, returning finally at long last, is Brian Coleman, our associate producer. Brian, welcome back. The big trip from South Africa and Germany, I guess.
Yeah, hey guys. Yeah, it's definitely great to be back. Spent about 3 weeks in South Africa and a week in Germany. Have a bunch of listener recordings. And I guess over the next few weeks, I'll share them, and just had a fantastic time. Highly recommend to everyone, take a four-week vacation. you can really get used to it.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's probably almost as good as being retired. Almost.
Almost.
Almost. Rob Mark is planning on joining us. Rob, of course, is the senior editor at Flying Magazine. In fact, he's working right now on a story, but he tells us that he should be joining us in progress, so we'll see how that goes. Well, our guest this episode is Katie Pribble. She's the Senior Vice President, Aviation Strategy and Programs with AOPA, the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Now, Katie's responsible for the AOPA You Can Fly program and the Air Safety Institute. Many of you already know, but the You Can Fly program includes initiatives to get lapsed pilots back in the air. It provides more affordable access to aviation through flying clubs, also best practices in flight training, and it also introduces high school students to aviation. And then the AOPA Air Safety Institute produces free programs that help pilots fly safer. Katie, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hello, you guys. It's great to be with you. I'm speaking to you from AOPA's headquarters tonight in Frederick, Maryland.
Fantastic. Now, you've got a pretty extensive aviation background. You are a graduate of Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. You flew the Canadair Regional Jet with Atlantic Coast Airlines, Independence Air. You've also served as the Director of Communications for GAMA, the General Aviation Manufacturers Association. CFI, and you're a rated seaplane pilot and a member of Ladies Love Tail Draggers. That's because you have a tail dragger, don't you?
I do. I have a 1956 Cessna 180, and I call him Buck, and I am a very proud member of Ladies Love Tail Draggers and the 180-185 Club, and, you know, just I think all those organizations are just great ways to support general aviation and keep our community really active and engaged. But, yeah, it's been really fun being an aircraft owner for the first time, and, you know, all those joys and realities of owning a vintage aircraft are all coming true.
Oh, yes. We're going to be talking about that and some other of your activities coming up. But let me just ask now, is it difficult to maintain an airplane like that when it's that old?
Well, you know, it's hard for me to know because I have really nothing to compare it to. The first airplane I've ever owned, I just went vintage, you know.
Hmm.
I found this airplane actually on eBay.
Really?
Mark Baker found this airplane on eBay for me. He knew I was looking for a 180. I wanted a tail dragger to be able to fly back to my family's ranch in Montana. And he found this thing on eBay. So, you know, it's been a challenge learning this airplane and maintaining it. I've had to do a lot of work to get it really reliable, but it's running beautifully, and I'm really I feel a lot of responsibility in maintaining and keeping an old airplane running and operating properly. It's quite a privilege.
Wow. I didn't know Mark had enough time, enough free time to browse through eBay.
We let him search the internet at late at night.
Okay.
Know, when, when he's not working at AOPA.
Very good.
But no tweeting, right?
No tweeting. No.
Yeah, no late night tweeting.
No, you know, we didn't even have to take that away from Mark. He's not that kind of guy.
Yeah.
And Max, I just heard today, I believe it's China, has two 777s or 747s available on eBay. So if you wanted to... Yeah, eBay seems to be the place to be selling aircraft now.
I guess so.
If you want a wide body, you can go on eBay and put your bid in.
There you go.
I don't know if I highly recommend it, but, you know, it was a good experience.
Yeah. All right. Well, why don't we jump into some of the aviation news from the past week? So I'll ask, is everyone ready?
Ready. Ready from the West.
Ready.
Our first story, well, actually it comes from Embry-Riddle. This is Embry-Riddle sees rising number of students in nation's largest collegiate flight training program. In this release, Embry-Riddle says that the incoming freshman class is the largest it's been in 15 years into the university's flight training program. The chair of Embry-Riddle's flight department, Dr. Ken Burns, says that there are several contributing factors. One is demand across the U.S. has grown for more commercial airline pilots. There's been an increase in the starting salary for commercial pilots. And a little plug for Embry-Riddle, he says there's a quicker return on investment now with a degree from Embry-Riddle. So last year, there were 1,150 students enrolled in aeronautical science. And this year, in 2017, we see 1,350 students starting. So if my math is correct, that's a 17% increase. There are some historic figures in this piece as well. In 2001, there were about 1,500 students entering the program, but it dropped after that and then held steady at about 1,100 for the last 4 years, and now we see this jump up. Katie, do you think that this might represent a trend?
Yeah, I really think it does, and I think it's a good trend. You know, after 9/11, the reasons for becoming an airline pilot aren't as strong as they are now, and, you know, we have the pilot shortage that's actually coming to fruition. We especially see that on the regional side. You know, we know regionals are having a hard time keeping pilots. We know flight schools have a hard time keeping flight instructors. So I think this is a really good positive sign. It's a good time to get into the airlines, and it's great to see the numbers tick up for Embry-Riddle. And I hear they're the same for UND and Purdue and other flight schools. So it's a good sign.
Max T, are you seeing an increase in interest from student pilots on your side of things?
Yeah, interestingly, I met with a lady today. She's in her mid-30s, comes from an Ivy League school. She currently works for one of the big five or four or however many consulting firms we have left in the country. She wants to get her pilot's license. And I said, almost half jokingly, and are you thinking you might be interested in a career in aviation? And she said, well, that's possible. Am I too old to become an airline pilot? And I asked her age, and I said, actually, no, you're not. And so she was kind of intrigued by that. And I think, as Katie just mentioned, the last time we really saw this kind of demand for pilots was prior to 9/11, and then demand dropped tremendously. And you may recall we had Tracy Gallo from SkyWest Airlines on here back episode 380, and he said that this is the best time ever to become an airline pilot. I think he's right with all the salaries doubling and more regionals. I'm not surprised that enrollment's up substantially.
Now, this is maybe jumping a little bit ahead, but Katie, in terms of the You Can Fly program, I mentioned that one component of that is introducing high school students to aviation. So I imagine that's a great opportunity to interest young folks in aviation, in just flying or even in an aviation career.
That's exactly right. I mean, we have seen such an interest from schools, teachers, educators, and students in wanting real education in their schools. So yeah, I'm really excited to talk about our high school initiative. And you're right, we've seen interest in more than just flying. You know, we are actually building pathways not only for flying, but also drones and aerospace engineering. So it's really exciting. Kids are excited about all these different career fields and pathways, and they see a real future in aviation. And I think that bodes well for aviation in the U.S.
And I think what's fun is it's not only for the U.S. There are a lot of jobs overseas with international carriers. You have the folks in the Middle East that are expanding. Turkish just placed a huge order for some Boeing aircraft. Norwegian is, I guess, being accused of stealing Ryanair pilots. So certainly if you want to be a pilot outside of the U.S., there's a pretty big demand as well.
Katie, I'm curious, when you are speaking, maybe not you personally, but the organization is speaking to high school students, how do you introduce them to aviation? What's the method that you use to kind of make them aware of some of the possibilities?
Well, so right now we're actually building aviation STEM curriculum for high schools to use as electives. The pathways will be career and technical education. It's kind of the new buzzword. It used to be, VOTEC, if you guys are familiar with vocational education. You know, CTE, career and technical education, is the new buzzword for VOTEC. But this curriculum, these pathways, ninth grade is going to introduce kids to just the entire breadth of aviation. And from there, they can choose which pathway they want to go down, whether it's flying or drones or aerospace engineering. That's where we're starting. But we're introducing, kids to aviation by having actual education classes in their school day. This is not an after-school program. This is an in-school program. And they will get high school credit for taking these elective courses. Right now, we have 29 high schools from around the country field testing our ninth grade curriculum. So it's exciting. I mean, this is actually happening, and we have these classes and these courses being taught in high schools today.
Do schools approach you, or does AOPA approach schools? How is that connection made?
Right. So for the most part, these schools are approaching us. You know, AOPA is fortunate. We have some really nice communication vehicles, whether it's through our members and, our email lists and our magazine and the video show. You know, we have a way to reach a lot of folks. And so when we put the word out that AOPA was building an initiative and wanting to gauge the level of interest from educators and teachers on having aviation STEM curriculum, we got a ton of response. A lot of them are teachers that happen to be members of AOPA. In other cases, our members went out and talked to teachers and educators in their areas and connected them to us. But we literally get calls every week. We can hardly keep up with it. Calls every week from teachers and educators that are interested in adopting our curriculum. And this fall, in November, we're having our third high school aviation STEM symposium, where we give educators and administrators and others from the industry an opportunity to come together. It's really the only place where aviation education comes together in one place to share ideas and best practices and learn about AOPA's curriculum. So it's the interest is truly there.
That's amazing. That's really great to hear. I think Rob Mark has joined us. Rob, are you there?
I certainly am. Good evening to everybody. Apologies for being late. Good evening, guest. I understand your name is Katie. I think we've met somewhere before.
We have, Rob. It's good to talk to you tonight.
How are you? Yeah.
No one who's met Rob forgets.
they might try to, but not usually successful. But Katie, what I was going to say is I always love to see a picture of a lady standing next to a big tail dragger.
Well, I got more where those came from.
So. Okay. So back to the discussion there about high schools.
Yes, Rob, we started talking about how Embry-Riddle is seeing an increase in the number of students and talking in general about the perception that, you know, maybe we're seeing the start of a trend, increasing interest and so forth, and talking about what AOPA is doing with high schools to generate interest at that level. How about from the standpoint of what you might see, Rob, do you see more interest in the flying club or in prospective students coming to see you or others you're aware of? Are you seeing anything? Is it kind of hard to detect at this point?
Well, it's funny that you ask this week because I spent my Friday last week at Lewis University just outside Chicago here that has a pilot program, an A&P mechanic program, and also an aircraft dispatcher program. And they were looking for mentors, so there were about, I'd say maybe a dozen of us that went. And I'll bet there were probably 100 students with lots and lots and lots of questions at various stages of the curriculums, and they were eager to go. Of course, now this is not high school. This is just post high school.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Well, that's great. So it does sort of feel like we're seeing increased interest. I think maybe. Well, I wonder if the increased career prospects are fueling that, or to what degree they are, both in terms of the demand for more pilots and also the trends we seem to be seeing in terms of increasing salaries. I think that's got to play a role.
Well, if that doesn't, if pilots being paid more money and being told how quickly can you graduate because we'll have a job for you when you do, I mean, if that doesn't get people going, what would?
You know, I think that it totally does, and that definitely plays a part. But I also think that you can't underscore just how cool aviation is right now. And, you know, kids and the ability for them to see, like, think about what's going on with commercial space transportation and SpaceX and all these companies that they know, like Google and Amazon and Facebook and others that are now getting into aviation. You know, and they're seeing aviation, I think, in a totally different way than like I did. You know, back in the 90s when I got into flying, right? You know, and these kids now with their devices and YouTube and all these things can just see all of these things in action. I mean, watching SpaceX recover a rocket on an aircraft carrier, like, wow, that is so cool, right? And kids are seeing that every day. And I think those kinds of things are also really driving a genuine interest from kids to get into aviation and some of the really cool stuff that's going on right now. And then I think you can't leave out drones, right? And what drones have done to get kids interested in aviation and aerospace as well.
Oh, I
okay,
I think
Katie Rob's here. You can't mention that word anymore. I know
sorry.
You were.
Hey, listen, did you guys not see my picture of my little baby drone?
Yeah, I don't know, you guys. I did not see that warning on this
yeah, I have a little baby drone that's sitting right here on the desk. But no, Katie, I was going to say, I think that's absolutely true. In fact, that exact same concept came up at the university discussion the other day, and someone mentioned SpaceX and Tesla and flying cars and drones and just so many really cool things that are happening in the industry. Oh, yeah. And then there is the fact that we're going to be short about a bazillion pilots and mechanics along the way. So I agree. I think that is also part of this this bonfire that seems to be going on for, the industry. Thank goodness.
It's very encouraging.
And Rob, you didn't mention Paul Allen's Strato Launcher as well.
Oh, right. The double 747 thing.
Yeah, that's been in the press a lot the last few days, where they apparently have just fired up the engines on that. I think it's six engines, as I recall. But yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that fly.
See, I might have been gone, but I'm still paying attention.
Yeah. I wonder if that's going to be a tail dragger. No, maybe not.
Only if they have a weight and balance problem.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's true.
All right, next item. This comes from the Dayton Daily News. Advanced joint technology, viable method for aircraft assembly. This is about the AFRL, the Air Force Research Laboratory, and Northrop Grumman have gotten together to test a new aircraft assembly method. So legacy aircraft assembly is basically that you bolt together large components and subassemblies and things. And nuts and bolts, well, it adds a lot of weight. It adds a lot of parts to the bill of materials, certainly, and costs a lot. So Northrop Grumman has been working on an alternative, adhesive bonded splice joints. There are some concerns over that. Concerns over, are the bonded joints strong enough? Are they reliable enough? What about the tolerance requirements? How sensitive are they to getting exact matching overlaps and all of that? So Northrop Grumman has been developing this proprietary method for bonding composite skin splice joints. And what we've seen here is that the Air Force has now performed some structural verification on these kinds of splice joints. And what they found is that the results have actually exceeded expectations. Now, obviously, when you test this kind of thing, you test them to failure. And under both tension and compression, the test samples have failed at higher levels of tension and compression stress than predicted. So they overperformed, basically. In some ways, the most interesting part of the story is the fact that it's an interesting combination of the government, in this case the Air Force, and private industry working to develop some new technologies and new methods. David, the AFRL, we've talked about some of the things they've been doing with respect to unmanned aircraft. So it's not an unusual situation to see this kind of industry government link up.
No, it's not. And it's going to be one of those things that we'll see more of going forward in the future, that the government is going to let the public sector lead and absorb their technologies. Polycarbonate and epoxies and resins for aircraft was bleeding edge for the Air Force, in the late 70s. It seemed like everybody did it. And immediately the two aircraft that reflect that most would be the F-16 and the F-18. And believe it or not, those are the aircrafts that got retired to the boneyard soon enough, because we were losing technology. We were losing wing structure failures because the carbon fiber didn't last as long as they expected it to. So I expect that the Air Force is going to start doing this a lot, where everybody's going to come to the Air Force with the technologies, and they're going to, instead of speccing it out like the old process used to be.
Now, as I was reading this, a thought occurred to me relating to subsidies, because we oftentimes see claims from one airframe maker or one country that someone else is enjoying subsidization from their government or from some other sources, therefore competing unfairly. In some ways, I mean, this is another form of subsidization, isn't it? What do you guys think?
Don't you think the technology will reach other companies overseas? It strikes me it's probably the kind of thing that will get published, or that there'll be folks working on it and who go back to their home country. I mean, it just seems to me like this is probably not going to be proprietary.
I don't know. The piece in the Dayton Daily News suggests that what Northrop Grumman has got so far is proprietary, they use that word, the degree to which it's locked up in patents and things, I don't know. But it does get complicated when the government's involved, because sometimes if the government is expending money in some program with industry, then you know, there has to be a sharing, or the government takes some ownership of the intellectual property. I don't know what the situation is here.
Right. And then if they would turn around and, let's say, license it to Boeing so they could make the parts stick on the 777 so they don't fall off like they did on the KLM flight, right? They probably make some money from that. Yeah, and then who does that money belong to? Does it get rebated back to the government? I seriously doubt it.
Yeah, probably not.
Well, I just got to give the perspective here as the engineer from Silicon Valley. I mean, we've been working on joint technology for a long time. First, we had the medical joints, then the recreational joints. So this is not new to us. It's been legalized recently.
I don't think we're talking about the same thing.
Oh, Max. Maybe I didn't read this.
I might be wrong. Right. I might be wrong, but.
Yeah, I thought the comedy show was on the other podcast that you did.
You know,
yeah.
I didn't realize Rob was on with us, because I would expect him to normally make these kinds of comments.
Oh, no. I have turned over a complete, well, at least one leaf. And
no kidding.
Actually, I've been turning over a lot of leaves in our neighborhood because it's fall, and I've never before raked leaves when it was 95 degrees out. But that's another story.
Yeah,
I'm going all jokeless this week.
Really? We'll probably lose a lot of subscribers. All right, let's move on to the next story then. This is from AIN Online. White House to nominate AOPA's Landsberg to NTSB. Well, there's an open spot on the National Transportation Safety Board, and the White House announced that Bruce Landsberg will be nominated for a 5-year term starting January 1st, and also a 2-year term as vice chairman. Bruce was on Airplane Geeks as our guest many, many episodes ago. I think it was episode 106. So that's like about 7 years ago. But it's great to see, Bruce being nominated to this position. Katie, everybody at AOPA must be pretty excited. Maybe excited to get rid of Bruce or?
No, we love Bruce. It's exciting, I think, to have somebody with his kind of breadth of experience, especially in GA safety, on the board. So I think it will be good for the NTSB and valuable to general aviation to have that kind of experience on the board.
Yeah, now the NTSB has just started or is about to start their own podcast. Rob, you've been looking at that a little bit, haven't you?
I have just briefly, and it's due to publish sometime, I think, in the first week of next month. They have a couple of technical folks there at the board with some media experience, and Eric Strickland is the contact that I spoke to at the board.
Yes, yeah.
And he's pretty excited about this. So he says, in fact, he mentioned something about, of course, I've never really done podcasts before, so I'm going to get a few of these under my belt and make sure they sound good before we actually release them. Hmm. So I think we should have done that years ago. So I think Eric's way ahead of us.
Yeah. In fact, they have released one sort of pre-episode. It's kind of like an episode zero. It's sort of an introductory episode that's out there. And we'll try to put a link to that in the show notes. But it sounds good. As we record this, it's not yet up on iTunes. It is in Google Play, I see. But yeah, we definitely look for it. We always love aviation podcasts.
I thought it was called Apple Podcasts now or something.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Apple Podcast app. Yep, they're trying to get away from calling it iTunes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say that I think Bruce's Landsberg is really an excellent choice. Not only is he incredibly knowledgeable about the field, but he's just an amazing communicator. We had him out as one of our speakers last year for Accident Wise 2016 that we held at Moffett Field here in Silicon Valley. And he's amazing. I mean, he's just absolutely an amazing presenter. So I think he's going to bring a lot of skills. And, of course, we've had the chairman, Walt on the show. And I think between those two, I mean, you got to really admire the selection of people they have running that agency now.
Yes, really, really talented group. All right. Let's see. Next item from the Irish Times. Ryanair to offer pilots extra 10,000 euros to stay with airline. This is, we've got Michael O'Leary again. in the news. Max T, what's going on here?
Well, it's an interesting story. Ostensibly, it was about Ryanair having to pay extra to get their pilots to stay with them. It goes back to something that Brian mentioned here a couple of minutes ago, which it's been alleged that Norwegian has been poaching pilots. Someone had come up with a figure that they'd taken over 140 pilots from Ryanair from last year, but Mr. O'Leary says, no, it was less than 100. So I guess
99.
Yeah, exactly. He's trying to make it sound like it's not so bad. But they did at Ryanair have to cancel a number of flights recently because of a massive scheduling problem. At least that's what they're telling everybody. Apparently, and you got to wonder, how does this happen? Apparently, their scheduling department gave, I believe it was 500 pilots 4 weeks off in September, another 500 pilots 4 weeks off in October. And now suddenly they are having to cancel flights because they say they goofed up in doling out vacation time. But you just have to scratch your head and go, that seems like a fairly basic capability. Is that really what happened? And if so, that's certainly a screw up of major proportion.
Well, Ryanair says he respects pilots, but...
Sorry.
This quote here comes from the video, which is on the story, and I encourage anybody to listen to it. But go ahead and read what he said in that video.
Well, he says, I respect pilots. That doesn't mean that they don't do a very easy job and that they are very well paid for doing what is a very easy job. We are in an era now where the computer does most of the flying. They're no longer there doing the flying themselves, but they are very skilled professionals. They do a very skilled job, and like most things where you really, I'm not sure if it translates.
It's true. This is actually the quote, and you know how when people speak, sometimes they come and hum and haw, and it's not a correct sentence, but yeah, go ahead and read it.
Things where you really, our pilots demonstrate that skill is landing in thunderstorms or fog.
Wow.
It's kind of an odd supporting statement, you know, behind the notion that he respects pilots. He just sort of stated in an odd way.
Oh, come on. He has as much respect for pilots as he does for customers.
Yeah, I think that's the ironic thing about this statement. He starts out about respect, and then just about everything he says does very little to respect. I mean, I like the part at the end here. But are they hard work, talking about the job? No. Is 900 hours a year or 18 hours a week on average likely to generate fatigue? No. But I think you could not fail to respect and admire the professionalism of not just Ryanair pilots, but of all commercial pilots, to which I say, right. You just look at them. He looks at them on a spreadsheet and goes, oh my gosh, how do we make this number smaller?
He really needs to finish that paragraph with, believe me, and then yeah. It would just be perfect. Yeah, I mean, wasn't he the one that also wanted to get rid of a pilot and fly them with one and eventually none? So, yeah, glad he respects pilots so much.
And we talked about that last week, and sure, that may happen in, 30 or so years, but the good news is anybody starting their aviation career now is probably not going to have to worry about that.
Again, we're speaking with Katie Pribble, Senior Vice President, Aviation and Strategy with AOPA. Again, Katie, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thanks again, you guys. I'm enjoying this conversation.
Oh, don't worry. That won't last, Katie.
So, Katie, tell us a little bit more about the You Can Fly program. We touched on its introduction of aviation to high school students, but what about some of the other aspects of the You Can Fly program that are important?
Yeah, let me start by talking a little bit about, why AOPA created You Can Fly. And, I think there's no question that general aviation and aviation in general is facing some big challenges. We've talked about some of those tonight. We've talked about falling pilot numbers. There's some alarming flight school dropout rates, which really concern us. And, in some cases, pilots just simply drift away from general aviation because they lack the support and motivation to keep flying. And, there's some statistics that really describe this. And I have one, for example, in 1980, the FAA was issuing more than 50,000 private pilot certificates on an annual basis. So 1980, 50,000 private pilot certificates. Wow. Do you guys know how many they're issuing on an annual basis now?
No.
Around 17,000.
Wow. What a drop.
Yeah. So we're talking about, more than a 60% decline in the number of certificates that the FAA is issuing on an annual basis. So, you know, and we have more statistics like this. You know, we know that more students drop out of flight training than complete it. And we've talked about it tonight. The aviation industry is facing some real challenges in terms of workforce needs and shortage of pilots, mechanics. We haven't mentioned that one tonight, and engineers. But AOPA doesn't believe it has to be this way. And that's why we created You Can Fly. We also don't believe there's a one-size-fits-all solution to solving these challenges. And that is why we built four very targeted initiatives that are aimed at addressing these most common challenges that I've mentioned. We think these initiatives together will invite more people to join our community and improve the experience that current and future pilots have and keep the pilots we have active and engaged. And so the four initiatives, you know, we talked about the high school initiative where we want students to discover aviation. Our flight training initiative is aimed at improving the experience people have when learning to fly, thereby improving the student pilot completion rate. We want to keep pilots active, engaged in our community. And we believe one of the best ways to do that is through flying clubs. And finally, we want to help those that fly out of flying for one reason or another rejoin our community through Rusty Pilots. So we have high school, flight training, flying clubs, and Rusty Pilots. And those are the four initiatives that make up the core of You Can Fly. And they're designed so that whenever a pilot needs help throughout their life cycle, AOPA is there to support them and get them flying or keep them in the game. And that was our thinking behind these four very specific initiatives.
Katie, let's talk about flying clubs a little bit. Are flying clubs healthy these days? Are they active? Are there enough of them? Where do we stand with respect to flying clubs compared to what we've seen in the past?
Yeah, you know, we have a flying club network, and our flying club network continues to grow every year. And in fact, since we've started our flying club initiative, we've helped start we've helped start 57 new clubs. And in fact, today I just got the news. We helped start a new club today officially in Kentucky. They just got the paperwork for the airplane that they bought. It's an equity club in Kentucky that bought a Cirrus. So
cool.
It's exciting. Yeah. I mean, we've been there. The interest in starting clubs is real. And it's exciting that we have headquarters staff here and the resources available to really help people start and finish that process. It's not necessarily an easy process. There's a lot of rules. There's FAA rules and regulations. There's a lot of IRS rules and regulations. And we help clubs walk through that process from A to Z. So, yes, I would say the interest is definitely there. You know, clubs really are a really good way to fly cost effectively. You know, being able to share the cost of ownership. We know that owning an airplane is really prohibitive for a lot of people. And they get that private pilot certificate and look in the mirror the next morning and wonder what they're going to fly and how they're going to do that. Hmm. And flying clubs is a great answer for them.
Now, when you talk about a club, is that could that be as few as two people? I mean, what size clubs are you typically seeing and that you're able to help?
Generally, we see clubs with four members or more. You know, and clubs can be equity or not equity clubs. So if it's an equity club, that means the members of the club own equal shares of the airplane. A non-equity club is that they might like lease the aircraft from one member of the club, and they pay that owner like an hourly rate to operate the airplane. So there's a couple different ways to there's actually many different ways to structure clubs. But it's exciting to see the interest that flying clubs are generating now.
Rob, the flying club that you're in, what's the motivation been for most of the club members? Is it just that to be able to have aircraft available to fly?
Pretty much, sure. And one thing that I have to admit that we've seen is that we have about 80 members, and we have been struggling a bit lately to get people out flying. I mean, honestly, they have a really nice Piper Archer that's all glass, and there's an older Cherokee there that's a little less expensive to fly. And but we get an awful lot of people that are members that just don't go anywhere. And that's, I don't know, Katie, have you seen that with other clubs? I mean, maybe we're an anomaly. I don't know. I didn't honestly have anything to do with it myself, I don't think.
You got to stay out of the club clubhouse.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You know, actually, we've just done every year on an annual basis, we do flying club surveys. And we were just actually looking through the data from this last survey. And we found that the healthiest clubs are clubs who do a lot of activities together. So, and we see on average, they're actually growing clubs in when we measure that in a couple ways, by the number of aircraft that are in clubs and the number of members. Do you guys do, as a club, a lot of social activities and monthly gatherings and safety meetings and picnics and those sorts of things? Is that something that's a hallmark of your club?
Well, it was. I can't say we did a lot of flyouts. They really didn't. We would have a breakfast once a month, and we would get tremendous attendance. We'd have half the membership show up for breakfast just to shoot the breeze about airplane kinds of things. And we just recently started this kind of flyout sort of eventing, and we're going to see how it goes. But it's tough sometimes with only two airplanes, because then people say, well, I'd like to go, but I can't even get a seat.
Right, which is why things like breakfast or airplane washes, just a reason to bring your family out to the airport, is such a great way. We found a direct correlation between healthy clubs and the number of social activities that they're doing. So I'm glad to hear you guys are bringing the flyouts back. I'd encourage you to try the breakfast again, too, because it really does give
those we haven't,
we
never eliminated those. Those have always been going. And again, they are great. We just haven't translated them quite into the flying part as much as we would like to. But I thought we were supposed to have car washes. So so when I would bring my car out and try to get people to wash it, that might have had something to do with it, you think, huh?
Yeah. I'm glad you've turned over a new leaf and are more serious. And Katie, I was going to say, my club out here is kind of the opposite extreme. We've got 40-some aircraft. And yes, we have tons of the kinds of events that you talked about. Usually a couple of safety seminars every month, usually a lunch barbecue every once a month, bagels available every Friday when people walk in the door. There was just a party on Friday to celebrate the 45th anniversary of the club. 100 people, you know, turned out for that. So, yes, I think all those kinds of things really help a lot.
Yeah. I mean, the community aspect of clubs and what that brings, you know, it really creates stickiness for people in general aviation, I think, you know. A lot harder to leave aviation when you've got really good friends in a community that you're a part of, that you really feel genuinely a part of.
I was going to say, I think that's how people actually get brought into aviation, is it looks like a club from the outside. And I think it's important for those of us in aviation to ask people, you know, from the outside to come join the club. That is, invite them to the airport, invite them to find out more about aviation. And so, yeah, you've got to look at the whole industry as a club that people from the outside looking in sometimes don't feel that they can be a part of.
Absolutely.
Hey, Max T, who pays for that?
You know, so the club charges members a membership dues every month. And, you know, you multiply that times all the members. That provides enough overhead to pay for those kinds of things.
And as a member, no one's resentful or thinking money's being spent foolishly. They're quite happy to pay that as a membership due to be able to participate in these other events.
Yeah, I've never heard anybody complain that the events are superfluous and people don't want to support them.
Great.
So a way to avoid that is actually, you know, when clubs, to really meet the FAA's definition of being a club and to follow the IRS rules, you have to have bylaws and all those sorts of things. So a lot of those things can be, you know, solved through a governing board that, you know, is voted on by the members, and bylaws which outline how money can be spent and what dues are and special assessments and those sorts of things. So really good clubs that have a nice, strong and solid governance set up like that really can avoid a lot of those issues.
Yeah, and our club has gone through ups and downs, and you're right. Those are important kinds of things, and I think that clubs go through cycles. There are going to be times when people are enthusiastic and working hard, and other times when you know, perhaps the management is not as good and so on. So, yeah, it really requires a lot of work from members on the board to make everything continue to work well.
Sounds like a business, right?
Yeah, it is sort of, but it's not. But it's not. Yeah,
absolutely. No, but it's still. They go through this the same. I think some of the similar issues with ebbs and flows, and leadership changes and those sorts of things. And you know, you're right. Clubs need to work through those things.
Katie, what is the FAA's interest in clubs above and beyond their interest in just individual pilots?
Well, I think, you know, the FAA also recognizes the great benefit that clubs can bring to the community in keeping airplanes flying and keeping people active and engaged. So they've been good to work with in terms of, you know, helping us understand and the rules and encourage rules that really allow for clubs and the essence of what we're trying to get at with clubs, which is, you know, lower the barriers to entry and lower the cost of flying.
So are there regulations that deal specifically with clubs?
Yes, there is FAA policy dealing specifically with clubs. Yep. Oh. And you can go on aopa.org/youcanfly. And we have a whole bunch of resources on flying clubs that a guide that walks you through the FAA policy, the IRS rules and regulations and other things you want to consider when you're flying a club, like bylaws and, you know, budgets and those sorts of things. Yeah.
Okay. How about the flight training initiative? How is that coming along?
It is coming along well. It's a big bite out of the apple, right? Helping improve flight training. You know, we know through research that about 70-80% of people who start flight training never finish. You know, and that's people who walk into a flight school door, inquire about flying, take a discovery flight, maybe some of those folks solo, maybe they even finish their cross countries, but they just never take a check ride. And that's a really pretty alarming dropout rate. Mm. And we know that while time and cost is a factor in that completion rate, we know that you know, a poor customer experience sometimes and a low value proposition is an even bigger factor. And so through our flight training initiative, we're aiming to improve that pilot completion rate by helping flight schools create that optimal flight training experience. And we're going to do this through support to schools, help them make their business works, you know, things like lead generation and customer service training and engagement tools to really keep students in the game once they get started.
I know one aspect of this that we've talked about several times in the past is the importance of matching the flight instructor to the student.
Yes. Yes. And you know what? So that is one of the things that we've been talking about and we'll include in our resources to flight schools, right? So there's a great flight school out in Seattle, Rainier Flight Training. And they allow their new students to interview flight instructors that are available. That's great. I mean, you know, allow and that's free, right? That doesn't cost the school anything. You know, you put the flight instructors that are available at the time, let the students meet them and find a match. And I think it's also important that chief pilots or, you know, flight school managers and owners are really involved with each one of their students and asking questions and making sure that relationship is working for the flight student. Sometimes it just doesn't click, and that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, but the flight school needs to be involved and needs to be aware of that so they can make a change when necessary.
Yeah.
And those things don't really cost anything. You know, we know that there's a shortage of flight instructors and not every flight school has a plethora of flight instructors to offer students. But, you know, when they do, certainly helping the match the flight school or the flight student to the CFI is something that's really important.
All right. Katie, can you tell us a little bit about the Air Safety Institute and what's been going on there lately?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the Air Safety Institute, it's been around for a number of years and over 2 million times ASI's resources are used every year. And lately, you know, and that includes everything like accident case study, our courses. I'm sure many of you have been to ASI's live seminars. We have another series going on right now, a new series called Fly By Night. So if there's an ASI seminar coming to your area, it's getting rave reviews, make sure you go. But we've noticed an uptick in video. You know, we've seen this with YouTube and other ways that people are consuming information these days, but video is really starting to go through the roof. So our strategy next year is to start incorporating more video into our safety education and training. So we're excited about that.
And AOPA has some, I think, really skilled video production people. Either that or, I don't know, maybe you outsource it. I don't know. But I'm thinking of the, you know, the AOPA Live this week podcasts, video casts. Just some of the videos that I've seen seem to be just really, really well done. They don't have the look of some organizations where it's, you know, they ask the intern if he could take his camera and, you know, shoot some video. They're really well done.
Thank you. Yeah. I'll be sure to pass that along. And they're professionals, and that's in-house folks.
You know,
these folks work for AOPA. Yep.
Yeah, cool.
Yep. Our AOPA Live team is all in-house, and we have several videographers that work at the Air Safety Institute as well, delivering specific videos. And they I don't know if you've heard our new ASI podcast, but we have a safety podcast out as well. We've had a couple episodes so far, so go check those out. Our first one was with Patty Wagstaff, and we talked to Lee Louderback from the P-51 school down in Florida. So those are exciting as well, and we have an in-house staff that produces all those.
Yeah, I think, that podcast just started, I think, this year.
It did.
May
yep.
or something like that, I think.
Yep, just a couple months ago.
Cool. All right. Yeah, we'll put a link to that in the show notes as
Perfect.
Well, so that you can, you all can find that. All kinds of great. You know, there's so much stuff at AOPA at the website. It's just amazing. And I'll give my little very short spiel, which is that you don't have to be an aircraft owner or operator to belong to AOPA, because I've been an AOPA member ever since. I don't know. I've been an AOPA member for
5 years.
Was it 5 years? And I'm neither an aircraft owner or operator, but support the organization that way. And I recommend it. And of course, there's others, the EAA. I think, Katie, you're an EAA member as well.
I am. I'm a member of EAA, the Seaplane Pilots Association, the 180-185 Club. I think being members and active contributors to those groups are really important for GA and for our community. I also have to mention that our Air Safety Institute resources, those are free. You don't have to be a member to access any of our Air Safety Institute education and training. So, you know, all of it is available through our website.
And Max, we should also say that they now invite those operators of unmanned aerial systems also.
Yes, of course. Right. And we've talked about that, especially on the UAV Digest, where AOPA has been very active. Well, we had Kat on this podcast, David, or on the other one?
No, Kat was on ours, on UAV Digest.
So yeah, these things all just blend together. It's all aviation, right? It just all blends together in my little brain. But yeah, I think that was, or it is just amazing that AOPA is, you know, looking into the future and seeing that unmanned aircraft, drones, are, you know, a part of aviation as well. And have taken some great steps to incorporate that into the organization. Do you fly drones, Katie? Did I see that somewhere?
You know, I have flown a drone. I wouldn't call myself a drone pilot. I haven't gotten my 107 certificate yet, but it's on my list. On my list. It's great. We have several drones here at AOPA that we use for education and training and even for media. So I definitely have the opportunity and the interest to do that. But yeah, I think AOPA is a great organization to bridge the gap that exists between manned and unmanned pilots today. And, you know, that's our goal. We want to integrate drones safely into the airspace, and we want to invite these new pilots to our community. They are a part of aviation. Drones are a part of aviation.
And then we just wanted to mention that for those of you who are AOPA members and maybe thinking, Katie Pribble, why does that name sound so familiar? You were featured in the January 2017 issue of AOPA Pilot magazine, the story A Daughter's Homecoming, which was a great story. We talked a little bit about that before we started the show, and we'll put a link to that article in the show notes so you can see that, as well as a really nice video that tells the story of you, Katie, and how your family had an interesting aviation experience several generations. Does it go back to your great-grandmother, was it?
My great-grandmother and my grandfather, yes, flew in an old Waco south of Great Falls, Montana, from Great Falls to our ranch south of town. They got stuck in town. They had ridden to town with the mailman And they got stuck because the roads got washed out and they were running out of money. So they walked across Great Falls to the airstrip that was there at the time. And they hired Earl Vance to fly them both home in his Waco. Landed on a hayfield above the ranch house there. And it was my grandpa's favorite story to tell of all time. So, yeah, you know, I'm the only pilot in my family. You know, I started flying in high school and still the only one in aviation. But, you know, aviation and that thread and that my grandpa's story really made an impression on my family. And it's weaved aviation through our family, despite me being the only pilot.
It's a great story. And we won't spoil it by telling the whole story. Just invite you to visit the show notes at Airplane Geeks and either read the article or, as I say, we'll have the video there. But as I recall, Katie, wasn't there also a 747 nose in the airport window that was kind of a big influence on you?
It's true. You know, I mentioned I grew up on a cattle ranch, you know, in Montana, and I thought I wanted to be a veterinarian since I was a little kid. And in high school, I was in 4-H. You guys might know 4-H. And I had the opportunity through 4-H to go on an exchange trip to Japan. And
just let me chime in. Katie, have you been in clubs your whole life?
Yeah, I'm a joiner. It's true. I can't deny it. So anyway, I had this opportunity to fly to Japan as a high schooler and live with a family overseas. And I had flown on the airlines before, but, you know, I was younger. And I just remember on the way out to Japan, I was in San Francisco making my connection all by myself, 16 years old. And I walked around the corner at the San Fran airport, and this nose of the 747 was in the window. And it just totally, totally sparked something in me. Just that one image. And I just remember thinking that whole trip, there was something that had been stirred. And by the time I had gotten back from that trip, I decided I was going to be a pilot. And you can imagine my parents' surprise. I literally told them when I got off the air stair of this Dash 8 that I flew back into Great Falls on, you know, it was 1995. And it's when, you know, anybody could walk out on the ramp. And my parents were there at the bottom of the air stair. And I told them right there that I wanted to be a pilot. You could imagine their surprise.
Well, it's amazing sometimes how small a thing can have a large impact on a person's life. Well, all right. Is there anything else that you wanted to tell our listeners about what you're doing or AOPA? Well, first of all, tell us where they can find AOPA online, where they can find you on Twitter, all of the social media things that you might be involved in.
You bet. So go to AOPA.org. If you put a backslash and type in "you can fly," you'll be able to find all the resources that we have around our four You Can Fly initiatives: high schools, flight training, Rusty Pilots, and Flying Club.
Max here. Sorry for the interruption. I tried that link and it didn't work. So instead, go to youcanfly.aopa.org, and that'll take you to the You Can Fly page. All right, back to Katie.
You can find me on Facebook. I'm Katie Pribble, and it's spelled P as in Peter, R-I, B as in boy, Y-L. And you can find me on Facebook. I'm not super active on Twitter, but AOPA is. So check out AOPA's Facebook and Twitter pages. And I also have to make a shameless plug for ASI's, the Air Safety Institute's Facebook page. It's very large, and every day they're putting up fun safety quizzes and those sorts of things. So it's a really engaging Facebook page if you haven't been there.
Fantastic. Brian, did you have one last question?
Actually, this week, no. I'm trying to turn over a new leaf.
No. Oh,
that was your leaf.
That's my line.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, I have a question. Katie, how did you end up in a 180 of the, and for listeners, the airplane that I see Katie flying all the time is a Cessna 180 that has the steering wheel on the wrong end, as some people call it.
It is. It's a 56, so it's one of the early straight tail models. So, you know, it really came down to the mission, right? And I knew that wanting to be able to fly at the ranch and connect aviation back to my family in a direct way was something really important to me. So when I started looking for airplanes that could land at the ranch and fly between Frederick, Maryland and Montana reasonably fast, you know, the 180 seemed to come to the top. And I love backcountry flying. I am an outdoors person. I love camping. I love fishing. I love hunting. You know, so having an airplane where you could throw all that stuff in and have great performance in and out of backcountry strips, you know, the 180 and the 185, those are unique airplanes. It just rose to the top.
How long does it take to make the flight from, say, west to east from Montana back out to work?
Talk about a commute. Yeah, it's about 11 hours of flight time.
Okay, and you do this every Friday and then go back on Monday, right?
Right. Yeah, AOPA gives me a lot of time off. No, I actually do it once. Well, okay, so last year I did it twice and I decided, no, it's going to be once. So I took the airplane out at the beginning of the summer season and brought it home Labor Day weekend. So I'll go out several times throughout the summer and use the ranch as my launching pad. I had a great trip this summer down to Johnson Creek for a 185 conference. If you guys haven't been to Johnson Creek or the Idaho Backcountry or any of our listeners haven't, man, you need to check out the Idaho Backcountry.
Oh, okay, all right, wait a minute. Okay, what for those people from outside the United States, what's a crick?
I'm busted.
Oh, man.
It's in my neck, I think. Yeah, it hurts.
No, in fact, it's really funny because the Pilot Proficiency Center up at Oshkosh every year where we do the simulator work in the Redbirds and give people a chance to fly unusual profiles has Johnson Creek in it. And I never knew what it was until I started that. And I went, whoa, this is probably exciting. So I guess in real life it is, huh?
It is exciting. I mean, Johnson Creek is just a beautiful strip. But from there, you know, there's all sorts of strips in the Idaho backcountry of varying degrees of difficulty and expertise required. Johnson Creek is one of the easier ones. It's nice and wide and very long, beautifully maintained grass. But there's other strips back there that are like county roads, landing on gravel county roads. And really, so there's something for everybody back there in terms of degrees of difficulty and challenge to get into. But it is I highly recommend, you know, going in with people who have great experience. It's a great learning experience, and it certainly made me a better pilot. Flying a tail dragger has made me a better pilot, and I know what to use my feet for now. So
just like when you got your seaplane rating.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, it's exactly the way I feel.
I really encourage, you know, people say, what should I do in aviation? How do I, you know, I recommend that go get an additional rating or a sign off. Even if you might not use it, it's just such great experience. You don't know what it's going to, you know, open your eyes and open your flying aperture to, you know, but man, it's good. It'll make you a better pilot to challenge yourself in a new way like that. That actually the next one on my list is my glider rating. I wish I would have gotten my glider rating sooner. And I think that's another one, kind of like learning to fly a tail dragger, where you kind of go back to the basics of flying and you really hone your stick and rudder skills. And I think that's important. And it's fun.
So boats and planes are almost always referred to as females. How did Buck get to be a male airplane?
Oh, my gosh. Have you ever flown a Skywagon?
Absolutely.
So, you know, I flew this airplane for a couple times. I didn't know it initially. But, you know, I just thought, you know, this airplane is trying to buck me off. And that has got to be a male, right? It's pretty obvious to me.
That's right.
I got to also tell you that, you know, Mark Baker was influential in helping me decide on a Skywagon and also find the airplane for me on eBay. But he initially called it Buck 80. He wanted to say, you know, how's Buck 80? Did you get Buck 80 yet? You know? And so, not only is trying to buck me off, but, we used the term buck, very early on when I first started looking at Skywagons.
Got it. So you're clearly having fun with him, with Buck.
All right. I think you're having fun in general, Katie, with all of this great stuff. We really want to thank you for coming on the show and talking to our listeners. We'll have lots of links to the things we talked about in the show notes for sure at airplanegeeks.com/471. So be sure to check those out. And again, Katie, thanks so much.
Thank you, guys. And before I go, I really have to thank you for what you do. This podcast is incredible. You have thousands of listeners. You share a lot of really important information, and you're a connection point for our industry. And so thank you for doing this. It's important to keep in general aviation and aviation in general going.
Great. Thank you. You're very kind. Thank you. All right, what's up with the geeks? Let's see, we've touched on a few things. Rob, what have you been doing lately since we last talked to you?
Well, I stuck a picture in the Google Doc there for you guys to look at. But this last week, it's funny, we were talking flying clubs here when Katie was on, and I had somebody connect with me through our flying club website that was looking for an instructor, and said he had just gotten his private and he was trying to figure out what he wanted to be and all that sort of good thing. And so he was really interested in a tail dragger, which, of course, kind of piqued my interest. And I just started corresponding and chatting on the phone and giving him resources and saying, well, this is just my two cents, but you might look at this or you might look at that. And next thing I know, Evan calls me about a week ago and says, hey, I bought an airplane. I said, you bought an airplane? And Max T, you'll appreciate this. The guy has 53 hours total time, and he got his certificate about 3 weeks ago, and he did the he took an entire month off in August and flew every single day, 7 days a week until he got his license. And I thought, holy smokes, when was the last time you saw somebody do that? That wasn't a you know, at some flight academy or something like that. But anyway, so we went out last weekend out of Pewaukee and went over to Quad City and Moline there along the Mississippi and picked up that great little restored PA-22 Tri-Pacer that we put, you know, we'll put the photo in the show notes. But talk about basic. It was a very basic airplane. It had a communications radio and a transponder and a compass. That was about it.
Yeah.
So, and I completely forgot about the fact that it didn't even have a VOR. And as we were heading out, I was talking about how easy it was to find. We were headed back towards Chicagoland, and I said, "Oh, how bad can it be? You reach Lake Michigan, all you got to do is figure out which way to turn, left or right." But it was a lot of fun being out there in an airplane that didn't have any glass, anything like that, but it was really a hoot. So Evan's all excited. You'll see his picture there, standing next to this airplane that he has an entire hour and a half in now. So he's pretty proud. And we got a little more work to do, but he'll be out flying that thing by himself pretty soon.
Good, Max T. You met with one of the listeners, did you?
Yes, I had a gentleman who contacted me a month or so ago, Gerard, who is from Ottawa, Canada, and he was down here for business, and his wife was also here, and he wanted to fly a Cirrus. He normally flies a Cherokee 180 out of Ottawa, one of the smaller airports just outside of town there. So we hopped in one of the SR-20s here at the local club, did a little over an hour just tooling around the San Francisco area, showed him all the sights, Alcatraz, the Golden Gate Bridge, and down the coast a little bit. So, yeah, just kind of your typical, you know, afternoon flight. I mean, there are so many fun things to see here. It's in an hour, you can just see, you know, a lot. And as I mentioned in the intro, yesterday I was out flying over the Monterey Bay down at 1,200 feet just to stay above the marine sanctuary there. And a great view of the whales down below. So it's whale season again, and they're out there, and it's fun. Even from 1,200 feet, we could see when they would raise their heads out of the water. And one of them actually came up and slapped down on the water. So it's fun. Wow. Fun watching out here. I mean, flying is so much fun.
Yeah, that's just so amazing to see something like that from a vantage point like that. That's wonderful. Let's see, I'll mention that on episode 50 of the PaxX podcast, Mary Kirby and I talked with Kendall Creighton, who's director of communications for Flyers Rights. And we talked about aircraft seat spacing and ATC privatization and flyers' rights position on that. It was a great conversation. You'll recall, I guess last episode we talked about seat spacing and the Daily Beast article, the FAA's testing methods, which include simulations now apparently for evacuation times and all of that. So if you're interested in that, visit paxexpodcast.com. That's paxexpodcast.com. Look for episode 50. We hope you enjoy that. And then, of course, Brian, you're back from your big trip.
Yeah, I was really fortunate. I didn't have to worry about seat pitch on my flights because I actually got to fly in first class, and that was an awful lot of fun. So again, cashed in a whole bunch of miles for it. Found it really interesting where I had to wear a shoulder belt, and I guess that was to keep me from flying too far forward, where normally I guess you run into the seat in front of you. But when you don't have a seat in front of you, the shoulder belt comes in handy. So I found that really interesting.
But that was just for landing and takeoff, right?
Yes.
Oh. And you were in a bulkhead seat?
It didn't matter. Every seat in the cabin, you have a shoulder belt.
All right. So, yeah, we have a number of recordings you made to sort of document the trip.
Good. I'm glad you did that, Brian.
Yeah. And so why don't we start off with the first one here?
Hi, this is your associate producer, Brian Coleman, and I'd like to take a few minutes to kick off stories of my recent adventures to South Africa and Germany. I'll have other segments covering different aspects of the trip, but I wanted to start with the flight experiences I had getting from Los Angeles to Cape Town. I started my travels the long way around with a flight from Los Angeles to San Francisco on a United 737. Much to Rob's surprise, everything was fine. We took off and landed on time. At San Francisco, I made a great mistake. I forgot that United has a first-class lounge in the international terminal, and in doing so, I endured the discomforts of the United lounge that's under construction. They are building the new Polaris lounge, and as such, have taken space away from their existing facilities. It was very crowded and, well, just not an enjoyable experience. Thinking I should get to the gate earlier and stretch my legs before sitting on the 11-hour flight, I walked from the United Club to the gate only to pass by the United First Class Lounge. Taking advantage of my last 15 minutes in San Francisco, I ducked into the lounge and had a pre-flight snack and beverage. You have to try the food if you're going to be there, right? The food and beverage selections were so much better than the standard United Club. Sure, they aren't as nice as other international carriers' lounges, but for a domestic carrier, they're just fine. Rushing through my snacks, I made my way to the very crowded boarding area. The 747 boarding process went without issue, and I started to enjoy my seat, 1A. The flight attendants did a good job, and I was able to experience the soft product of the United Polaris first-class service. Again, there is nothing great compared to other international first-class products. They're just fine, but certainly much better than sitting in economy. There was an issue on takeoff, however, where there was a vibration noise that came from the radome and above the storage closet and overhead bins. Everyone in the cabin had wide-open eyes, thinking the front of the plane was about to shake off. This wasn't the normal sound of the landing gear being raised, but a terrible vibration and rattle that most certainly got my attention and that of my fellow passengers. At about 5,000 feet, the vibration stopped and the rest of the flight was without incident. Even Rob would have been happy on this United flight. 10 hours or so later, we arrived in Frankfurt, where I had a 5-plus-hour layover. Yes, this was all scheduled and part of the plan. I could have gotten to South Africa faster, but I wanted to fly on the United 747 for one last time before the fleet goes into retirement. Anyway, in Frankfurt, I headed over to the Lufthansa First Class Lounge and was denied entry due to the fact that I was flying on South African Airways to Johannesburg. Disappointingly, I made my way to the Lufthansa Senator Lounge, had a shower, and enjoyed the buffet food and beverages. It's nice being able to take a shower between international flights, especially since I had another 13 hours or so of flights ahead of me. To kill some time in Frankfurt, I was planning on taking one of the many airport tours they offer, but no one could confirm if they were going to conduct them in English. With the walk to the meeting point a terminal or so away, I decided to forgo the airport tour and enjoy my time in the lounge. Lufthansa does a nice job with their Senator Lounge. Actually, their business lounges are quite nice as well. My next flight to Johannesburg was on an Airbus A340 on South African Airways. Captain Nick would have been proud. But this old bird seems to have seen better days. The plane, that is, not Captain Nick. Although he might have seen better days as well. Anyway, maybe everything was fine on the flight deck, but the cabin was dirty, old, tired, more so than the 747. And the in-flight entertainment system didn't work either. In addition to all this, we had to board the plane using air stairs. Haven't done that in a long time. I also wasn't expecting to have such an uncomfortable slimline seat in the business class section of the cabin. The customer service from the flight crew was uninspired at best. To me, it's no wonder South African Airways is going out of business. With a product like this for a 10-hour-plus flight, they really should go out of business. Yes, Rob, it was worse than United. Anyway, we landed in Johannesburg and I got a chance to try out the South African Airways Club. No first-class lounge, just the normal, regular club. Although the club was nicely appointed, the food that they had on display did not look edible, and the cheese sat out for so long, the edges had turned up and were cracking from being dried out. In addition, the bar was lightly staffed with limited selections. This was very disappointing, but not as much as what was to follow. In the lounge, checking on the flight status for the flight to Cape Town, I learned that it was delayed. They wouldn't say why, nor would they give me an idea of when they expected to take off. But they did say that they would keep us informed. Well, you know what happens next. 15 minutes later, they delay the flight. Another 15 minutes, another 15-minute delay. After about 3 hours, they finally tell us that they're ready to go. A much better alternative than canceling the flight, to be honest. However, instead of flying on the A321, they swapped the aircraft with an A330. Now, this wasn't just any A330, but it looked like a brand new plane, and we were the first passengers to fly in it. The seats were a bit more comfortable than that of the A340, but not much. I still don't know how they can make such uncomfortable slimline business class seats. The flight crew, however, was chipper and very accommodating. So much so, I thought I was on a different airline. Sure, the in-flight entertainment system still didn't work. Well, it kind of worked. They were showing a looping 30-minute infomercial at a resolution of what you could imagine 1950s television set would be, complete with all the static. But at least there was something to watch for a bit until I realized I could look out the window. The other interesting thing about this flight is because it was scheduled to depart before noon, South African Airways doesn't board alcohol. Yes, that's right. No booze on board. The crew was very apologetic, but said it was South African Airways policy not to stock or serve alcohol on flights scheduled to depart before noon. Even though ours departed well after noon because of the delay, there still wasn't any alcohol on board. Not a drop. So there we sat, watching the looping infomercial on every channel, enjoying the company of the very pleasant flight crew, and our fellow passengers who were just as disappointed as I was over the lack of breakfast beverages. But we had an enjoyable meal and our service was great on our way to Cape Town. In the end, we arrived safely in Cape Town. Isn't that the most important part after all? After 40-some hours of flying, I get to the hotel and start enjoying my trip of a lifetime. Next up, I'll have a recording of the meetup we had in Cape Town. For now, this is your associate producer, signing off.
Okay, so did you ever figure out what the vibration was on the airplane, the first one?
No, I actually didn't think at the time to have one of the flight attendants go ask the pilots, but they certainly didn't know either. It was really disconcerting, though. I had never heard a noise or a vibration so bad in all my flights.
Hmm. Interesting.
Isn't that sad, though, when you think of how far you went and how much time you spent on an airplane that I realize you went on points, but there were people that paid hard-earned dollars for the same trip, and think of how disappointing it was.
Okay, disappointing in which way? Or what part?
Well, I meant in the sense that some of the bits just didn't, I mean, you're on an airplane for I don't know how many hours and the in-flight entertainment doesn't work, or if it does, it's a continuous loop of an infomercial. I mean, that's pretty annoying stuff. You expect them in this day and age to get that kind of stuff right.
Yeah, certainly on the South African Airways flights. And again, I kind of nicknamed them a slimline business class seat, and they just didn't even offer first class on those segments. But it by far was the most uncomfortable seat I've sat in outside of coach. I have no idea how they can make such a torture chair like that. But you're right, all the other things, and going into the club, having the food being, you know, as bad of condition as it was. I'd be really upset if I paid. I was upset paying frequent flyer miles for it. I really expected more.
That's what I was going to say. I mean,
yeah.
Both of you, you're going down the dark path again.
Listen, you know what? He started it. I actually did wonder. Come on. Every airline experience can't be wonderful. Come on.
No, but for you two, everyone's a disaster.
David, wait for my future reports. It gets better.
Okay.
And it gets better in a big way.
He did it. He did that in 40 hours.
That's a long trip.
It's a long time. But do you know, if you go back to the 50s, that would have been 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
Even in the 60s.
I know.
Bob,
you're right.
Back when you were flying pterodactyls, you would be talking months.
That's true. That is true.
Yeah.
And David, I think the thing is, there are other carriers that are doing such a better job than the first two carriers that I experienced. And to me, part of the flight, the flight experience is important.
But Brian, that whole segment about United, you were actually disappointed that you had to report that you actually were having a good flight and a good seat. The tone of that was, I can't say something bad about United. What's wrong with this picture?
I didn't take it that way. I took it more as Brian being surprised, to be honest, but that was just me.
Again, he was surprised that he was having a good flight.
Well, it was United. Come on.
And I was having a mediocre flight.
Yeah.
It was good enough. Anyway.
Brian, should we play this Cape Town interview with Andrew?
Yeah, I really apologize for the quality of this. It did not turn out at all. I had a really good conversation with a listener of ours, Andrew and Paul, and the bit that I got with Paul just didn't record at all to a listenable level. So it was really fun running into some fellow airplane geeks and spending some time and talking with them. So, yeah, go ahead and run the second bit.
All right, here it is.
Hi, this is Brian, and I finally made it to Cape Town on my South African adventure. Along the way, managed to find some airplane geeks, and here we are at the Codfather restaurant. Not enjoying any IPAs, but some very nice South African wine. If we could, let's have everyone introduce themselves.
I'm Andrew Greenwell with San Francisco-based Airplane Geek, here with my husband, Paul. It was an interesting trip. It was not everything we hoped for. I mean, United coming over was actually pleasantly surprising and global first, but switching to African business on the A340-600 was a bit lackluster in the seating configurations and screen conditions, and even the flight crew who basically commented to us when we boarded that, well, we're just going to kind of hang on while the airline is broke. So that was kind of a letdown. But all in all, I think it got the job done, and we got here, and it was a little more uplifting on the A330-300 flying from Johannesburg to Cape Town, although they made you watch the exact same screen that everybody else had to watch. And in case you travel like I do, they don't serve alcohol on any flights that right before noon, so I recommend flying in the PM. But other than that, you know, they get the job done, but it's nothing to write home to mom about.
All right, so we have some other folks here that are a bit too shy to talk, but anyway, I'll check back in, let everyone know how the rest of the trip ends up. Thank you very much.
The Codfather, huh? That's seafood and sushi, huh?
Yeah, it was a really great restaurant. Anyone in Cape Town, highly recommend going to that establishment. And so it was really interesting. Met these guys on the plane from Johannesburg to Cape Town. And so really, really fun group of people. There was another person with us who just didn't want to talk at all. So it was... it happens. Yeah, you break out a recorder and all of a sudden everyone goes silent. But yeah.
Yeah, that's okay.
No, we had a great time talking about airplanes and the experience that we had. And David, it was completely unprompted what they said about the flight. It was a pretty miserable experience.
I don't hear them. I don't hear them every week talking about it.
Oh, I'll get them on the show next week. And yeah, we could do that.
All right. So
we could spin off a separate podcast, you know.
That's right. I just wanted to mention that I'm going to be in Huntington Beach attending the air show on Saturday. So if anyone wants to get together, because I'm not active on Twitter, please send me an email and we could get together. I have a media pass for the event, so looking forward to talking with some people and hopefully getting some recordings while I'm there.
Great. All right. Now a positive airline story of the week. What do we have here this time?
Yeah, so this comes in what an airline can do right. During Hurricane Irma, there was a bit of controversy, I guess, over some airlines who were accused of price gouging. And I find it really amazing and very uplifting that JetBlue announced that they were capping ticket prices and that they were charging no more than $99 for direct flights and $159 for connecting flights. And that was including taxes. And eventually, the other airlines followed suit, but I still think none of them had their prices as low as JetBlue did. And it really wasn't only the airlines who were gouging customers. I just really wanted to give a tip of the hat to JetBlue for doing the right thing and really leading the industry in a positive way and taking care of the people in the affected area.
Very good. Very good. That is a nice story.
And I'll throw out my family loves JetBlue. And my daughter lives in Boston. And whenever she comes here or whenever we go there, we fly JetBlue. They're great.
Yeah. All right, a little bit of listener mail first. Quickly, we got an article from our main man, Micah, from the Press Herald. This is bag fees driving up cost of lower airfares for many U.S. flyers. And what we see here is that reportedly the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, says that they were told by airlines that the base airfares are now lower than before airlines began separately charging passengers for checked bags, reservation charges, priority boarding, and all those other services. But the GAO's review of the studies out there says that the effect of bag fees on ticket prices shows that charging separately for bags reduce fares by less than the new bag fee itself. So a net increase. There's a quote from William McGee. He's the aviation advisor to Consumer Reports. And he says, quote, consumers should be able to shop for airline seats without being nickel and dimed and without getting hit with post-purchase sticker shock. And he's called for basic standards to curb these unfair practices. So it's something we've touched on now and again over the years, it seems. I think my big position on this is that it can be confusing when the fee structure is complicated, but I think in the end, consumers should be able to fairly easily be able to tell what the total cost is going to be so that there's no surprises, and early enough in the process so that they can comparison shop and get the full up price from all those airlines that they're considering.
You get what you pay for.
Yeah, with all the different booking systems, it's really difficult to get them to display all the ancillary fees. I wish that the airlines would go back to a single price for the ticket that they're charging, but I think that's never going to happen, or at least not in my lifetime. So, unfortunately, passengers just really need to be educated and be aware of what the policies are. And when they go to these consolidated booking tools, they just really need to be careful.
We heard from Jody Bromer, our favorite helicopter pilot, I think. Jody, like many of you, sent a message to her elected officials concerning her opinion on ATC privatization. And about 2 months after she sent her letter to, this is Senator Mike Lee in Utah. About 2 months later, she received a response. The senator, actually a representative of the senator's office, thanked Jody for her thoughts on the reauthorization bill and said that Senator Lee believes that the FAA reauthorization bill presented a prime opportunity to enact substantive policies to spur innovation in our aviation sector, reform inefficient programs, and cut unnecessary and burdensome regulations that increase travel costs for Americans. And then he goes on. Unfortunately, the final bill mostly maintained the status quo and did not accomplish these objectives. The senator looks forward to working with his colleagues to improve the FAA in the future. Senator Lee will be sure to keep your thoughts in mind as he continues to address the issue. So there's that. So we sort of add to our collection of responses from elected officials on this topic. And then Richard writes in after last episode where we talked about AvGeek Official, the event that took place in Ecuador, actually this year's version of the event that took place in Ecuador. And Richard says, imagine my surprise when you have a listener report of an AvGeek day in Guayaquil, Ecuador. You see, my wife is from Ecuador, and I have done a fair bit of traveling in that part of the world. He says, this was fascinating to me because, near as I can tell, in Ecuador, aviation remains the domain of the military and government and the major airlines. As a case in point, my wife and I just recently had her sister here, and as part of her visit, we went out to Chicago Executive, which Rob knows very well, where they have a little public observation area and park with some bleachers and benches. It blew my sister-in-law's mind to see the different types of aviation that we have here in the United States, but I do believe it may have sparked a bit of aviation fandom within her, as after that moment and explanation that in this country, with a bit of time and money, nearly anyone can learn to fly, she became, if not enamored, at least curious about the specifics involved in becoming a student of aviation. He says, it just so happens that my sister-in-law currently lives in Guayaquil, and while it was too late to advise her of this event this year, I have bookmarked the website and intend on paying attention to it next year to be able to apprise her of the next AvGeek Day. Hopefully there will be another one so that she may take advantage of it and see if there is something in aviation of interest to her. And then he sent along some photos and a couple of videos that we'll put in the show notes. One is a video that he recorded with his wife landing in Quito after their upon their return from Guayaquil, and another is a video taking off from the airport in Guayaquil. So we'll put those in the show notes. So that's from Richard. We thank Richard for sending that in. Again, you know, a little spark can pique someone's interest in aviation. Sometimes it doesn't take too much.
Amen.
We can each be that spark for someone else or introduce them to that spark.
Did anybody ever notice that Max Flight has never taken a Discovery flight? talk your way out of that one, man.
Well, there's been two. One was in a glider. One was in an aerobatic glider. I did that in Napa Valley. And the other was I went up in a decathlon. With a friend of mine. So, okay.
I stand corrected. I didn't.
And that cured you apparently, right?
Yeah, scared the hell out of me. I'm not going up there again. No, that's not true. No, I want my next flight to be in a biplane.
So you're waiting until a manufacturer comes out with one?
Yeah, until there's a brand new one built. No, a Stearman or, you know, something.
You will love that, by the way.
Yeah.
I treated myself to about an hour and a half ride in a Stearman for my birthday a number of years ago. Oh, my gosh. That was so much fun.
I really want to do that.
And, Max, we had a great time in the float plane up in Washington.
Yeah. That's another. Right? I missed out on Igor Sikorsky III's float plane ride because when I was up there with him a few years ago, his was was being worked on, so he wasn't able to take me around the North Main woods. But maybe I'll get up there again and be able to do that. Love to. All right, we need to wrap this one up. I want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We really want to thank our guest, Katie Pribble. She's Senior Vice President, Aviation Strategy and Programs at AOPA. Fantastic person, joy to talk to. Take a look in the show notes at the article that was in AOPA Pilot Magazine and the video that goes along with it. It actually kind of brought a little tear to my eye at the end. It's a great video. It's a great story. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes, they're at airplanegeeks.com/471. Look for where you can find us on social, at the website, how to contact us, how to subscribe, and there's a donate button if you'd like to support us financially. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
Probably anything that has Jetwine in the name or at flyingmag.com or within the pages, although as someone told me to mention, it's not really me. It's just the words that I've written.
Yeah. Max Trescott, where do we find you online?
Oh, the usual place. Just look for Max Trescott on Facebook or Twitter, or go out to aviationnewstalk.com and click on contact. And last week we had a show about check ride anxiety. So if you have a check ride coming out, check that up.
Great. And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
You can find me in Canada as of tomorrow, thankfully. I booked my boarding pass and paid my $25 checked luggage fee for, believe it or not, 18th century Bibles.
Who are you flying on?
I'm flying on Air Canada.
Oh, okay, good.
We're it's a hour flight from PHL to YYZ. It's not very exciting in a, as Grant McCarran would say, a jungle jet, an E-175. And you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, and you can find me on LinkedIn if you can spell Vanderhoof. And of course, on Fridays with that guy, Max Flight, on the UAVDigest.com. And this week should be interesting because I'll have, should have some interest industry experts from the conference.
Yeah, looking forward to that. All right. And Brian Coleman, how do folks reach you?
Oh, the next place they could find me is going to be at the Huntington Beach Air Show. And email is the best place to get a hold of me electronically. And that's Brian@airplanegeeks.com.
Is that a one-day or two-day air show?
It's a two-day air show. I'm only going to be there on Saturday.
On Saturday. Okay, great.
And the Blue Angels and, no, not the Blue Angels, the Thunderbirds and somebody else.
The Canadian Snowbirds.
Yeah, the Snowbirds are going to be there. Yeah.
If you don't know who's going to be at an air show, just ask David.
Yeah, no, it's kind of a big deal that both of them are going to be there. So really looking forward to that.
Cool. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David says, at the UAVDigest.com. Also, the PAXX podcast with Mary Kirby. Also on our Slack listener team. Boy, we've had some great conversations lately on our Slack listener team. Those guys get to enjoy some of the stuff we don't have the time to do on the show, or things that we do on the show, but they get to see them first. So check that out if you're interested. Just learn more at airplanegeeks.com/team.
Or when the co-hosts really screw up and we see how long it takes for someone to realize it.
Yeah, we get corrected almost immediately after release of the episode, which is great. Someone's paying attention. Also, intro music, Brother Love. Find his great stuff at brotherloverocks.com. Our outro is by our friend Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions where he kind of mixes in aviation sounds with other music at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
Well, hopefully, you know, the creek won't rise there before things change. Okay, have you got a 10-gallon hat, too?
You know, no, I have a belt buckle that's as big as a pancake. So
okay, all right. Hey, that's cool. That's
and not
cool.
A silver dollar pancake, I presume.
You can't wear a hat in the airplane. It's too tall, you know?
Yep.
Look for all of us, or look for where you can find all of us. No, that's not true. Look for where you can find us on social, at the website, how to contact us, how to subscribe, and there's a donate button if you'd like to support us financially. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
I thought we just said they were going to find out how to find us on the website.
Well, that's why I said, well, it's not really us. Not us individually, just us, the podcast.
I see. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm just very easily confused these days.
I wasn't very clear, so.
I see.
So okay. Where do we find you specifically as an individual the things that you do online?
That's assuming you'd want to find him, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Probably anything that has Jet Wine in the name or.
Do you publish jokes in Flying Magazine?
No.
Any thought of doing that or?
No. I have not worked for a large corporation for many, many years until this year, and I have learned quite a bit about corporations and certain elements of corporate life. Yes. And I would just say that we are not looking at the current moment at anything humorous.
Great. So you can keep saving them up for this show.
Yes.
All right.
I'll save them up for Max's show.